now we have a treatment. Certainly not a perfect treatment. We're still not there. But at least a treatment that offered hope to people with MS. By the way, just as a digression to put this into the perspective of how humbling a disease MS is and what great concern it is to patients. That period in September, in the summer of 1993, when Betaseron was launched, was one of the most trying emotional experiences of my professional career, because I literally felt that I had to play God. When Betaseron came out, there was not enough Betaseron to be given to all the patients who needed it. And physicians around the country taking care of people with MS were assigned a number of spots, people they could assign. I don't remember exactly what the basis for that was. But I literally pulled the names out of my head, because we didn't have any kind of records to access. So I pulled all the names out of my head and our records of people with MS who I thought were appropriate candidates for Betaseron. I literally put their names in a paper bag, and my nurse practitioner reached in and pulled out the names of the 8 or 10 people that were going to get Betaseron. Fortunately, that only lasted a few months till the drug became more readily available. Anyway, as soon as we had a drug, the question changed. The question now was, Doc, when are we going to have a pill? So now we have 3 pills, and we still have quite a number of injections, as well as 1 or now 2 drugs that are given by intravenous. There are other questions that have come up. Now when I talk to patients about medicine, another question that comes up is, how long am I going to have to take this medicine? And then, of course, there are many questions about the medicine. Probably the 2 leading questions that I get as a practitioner now, unrelated to the choice of drugs, is what about diet? Everybody with MS surfs the internet. Part of my counseling of patients in my first visit usually is stay off the internet. It's a very dangerous place for people with MS or perhaps with others. It's not quite that I tell them to stay off the internet. It's I tell them go to the National MS Society website or the Consortium of MS Care Centers website. But don't randomly surf the internet. Anyway, diet is a big question. And the other 2 big questions that I get from many patients are about cannabis and about stem cells. So those are the things that are on MS patients' minds. So I spend 80 to 90% of my time taking care of patients. I do a lot of work in clinical trials. I've had the privilege for, I don't know, maybe 13, 14 years to have served first as what was called the Chief Medical Officer for the National MS Society, and now I think I'm called a senior medical advisor to the National MS Society. My paycheck of 0 hasn't changed with the change of title, but that's been a privilege. So let me go around the room now, and I'd like everybody to introduce yourself and let us know maybe why you think you might be here. Start with Anne.
We have the opportunity to move back, so maybe if people don't mind the table being brought in while we do introductions, then
sure.
We can keep moving along.
I will be brief, since I'm probably the person in the room who knows the least about multiple sclerosis. I'm from Corey. I'm a pediatrician and epidemiologist and have worked until about 6 months ago in the federal government at agencies such as the Food and Drug Administration and the Centers for Disease Control. So I'll be here helping to facilitate the meeting, trying to answer questions that you might have about CORE or some of the questions or issues in comparative effectiveness that might affect the input that you give us on the questions when we do your work product at the end of our time together. Good to meet you all and welcome.
My name is Joe La Ferreira. I'm a patient representative. I'm associated with the Exploded Cure Project, which is a recipient of some funding from CORE. With that funding, Exploded Cure has helped put together the MSPPRN, Patient Power Research Network, that's being rolled out or has been rolled out in January officially as ICON for MS, so I'm on the governing board of that. And I'm also associated as a member of the community advisory panel on OPT-UP, which is one of those audacious observational studies that we have gotten some funding for, we'll even get some more funding for, and so that's my involvement.
Hi, my name is Mike Panzera. I'm a neurologist. I've been doing multiple sclerosis since probably almost over 20 years now in industry, most recently in the last 13 years, first advisor, and now I oversee MS clinical development at Genzyme. So I've been, over those that time, I've been involved in basically the development of five of the six last drugs approved for treatment of MS.
What have you done for sleep?
Well, most recently, 2 months ago.
3 months ago.
Good morning. My name is Laura Julian. I'm an MS neuropsychologist by training and outcomes researcher and policy researcher by training. I currently serve as a medical science director in medical affairs at Genentech. And prior to that, I was with the MS with the MS clinic at University of California, San Francisco.
By the way, there's now more room.
Sure.
Spread
out a little. Thank you.
In this corner, we can do a little.
Showering or moving?
Showering.
I'm Alyssa Aiden. I'm the Support Groups and Outreach Manager at the Multiple Sclerosis Foundation. We're a national nonprofit MS organization. We provide free support programs and services for people with MS around the country. And I'm also on the membership committee for MSPPRN, or iConquer MS. And I think I'm here really to represent some patients' points of view, because that's what we really do and who we're in touch with all day long and what we hear.
I'm Tom Kutze. I lead the National MS Society's teams that are responsible for advocacy programs and services for people with MS, as well as research. I primarily was largely responsible for the society's research efforts, but we've now unified all of our mission delivery into one large group that involves, you know, patient advocacy, a lot of programs and services for people around the country. And then also pretty robust research effort. I think I'm here principally to provide the patient advocate voice as well as some of the research perspectives.
Good morning. I'm Kim Bailey. I'm an engagement officer at PCORI, and my role, as my title indicates, is to partner with program officers at PCORI to monitor the engagement of patients and other stakeholders in PCORI-funded projects. And my current portfolio is everything that the clinical effectiveness research team has funded, plus some in the addressing disparity program. So if a targeted funding announcement in MS comes down the pike, it will be on my plate as well. And my role here today will be modifying our research questions as we go, which is why I'm here with two computers. We're going to try to catch everything in slides or on flip charts. So bear with me as I try to capture everything that you're saying.
I'm Lynn Hudson. I'm a neuroscientist. I had a lab at the National Institutes of Health, the Neurology Institute, for most of my life. I was, my lab worked on basic genetics and cell biology of oligodendrocytes, so I have a background in MS. I've been at the Critical Path Institute for 4 years now. I'm the chief science officer there, and I also am the executive director of the MS Consortium. Some of the members of that consortium are sitting at this table. They're the ones with the handmade tent cards.
Thank you, Lynn, for pointing that out.
We help the funding.
That doesn't help the funding.
So we have two consortia at CTAP that actually work on MS. The MS consortium is working on clinical endpoints that should be helpful also for any of the trials that the PCORI may fund. And we have a patient a patient-reported outcomes consortium that just started working on a PRO for MS, and that should also be, once it's qualified by the FDA, that should also be very useful. But even in our battery of performance measures that we're trying to put together for FDA qualification, we really are looking at clinical meaningfulness of those measures. So again, they should be, we want to make sure that they're the kinds of measures that are important to people living with MS.
Great. Sarah Vanger-Trudin, I'm the Executive Director of the Partnership to Improve Patient Care. PIPSI was basically created to create CORI, so CORI was under debate in Congress. PIPSI is a group of advocates that support CORI and really have continued to be strong advocates for CORI doing patient-centered research. So this is all, I think great. We're very excited to see the process of doing these.
Hi, everyone. My name is Sanjay Gandhi. I'm with Teva Pharmaceuticals. I am a health outcomes researcher by training as well. I've been doing health outcomes work 15-plus years. My current role at Teva is to make sure that when we design clinical trials, we do include the relevant patient-centered outcomes. So obviously, a very relevant discussion for us here in today's meeting. And also, I do observational work as well, which could be of the comparative effectiveness type. So,
hi, my name is Anya Miller, and I work with Alkermes, and I'm based in Ireland. We have an ongoing MS development program, so a lot of these discussions are part of the day-to-day discussions that we have at our companies as well. And I have a lot of interest in how we can bring different treatments to patients that give them different options and bring true benefit to patients. I've been working in the area of MS, I suppose, for over 6 years. My specialty is regulatory affairs, so I've got the piece that I look at, I suppose, is how you can bring some of these messages to patients in labeling. I suppose it's a big part of what I do. And then previous to Alkermes, I worked for Elan, where I was the global regulatory lead for Chesapeake.
My name is Peter Rogers, and I am a patient, person living with MS, and I came to this group. I learned after my work with the MS Research Program, this Congressionally Directed Medical Research Program. I've been with them for my last year, 8 years, so from the conception I was on that group to this year, my final year. Absolutely, I did it. We'll miss it. And I think you did a lot of really good work. And I was nominated by the National MS Society, and I learned that that's actually nominated me for the Life Started Glory back in October for that first panel meeting. And I'm excited.
I'm John Marler. I'm a neurologist. I began my research career at NIH. I led the stroke research program, clinical trials, became very interested in clinical trial methodology, the difficulties in the stroke community, developing new treatments, became an associate director of clinical research at the Neurology Institute, and then 5 years ago decided I wanted my own real world experience and went to the FDA, where, from my point of view, the rubber meets the road on clinical trial design, and it's been a very fulfilling experience so far.
Good morning. I'm Susan Hildebrand. I'm Director of Stakeholder Engagement at CORI. What that means is I try to involve, I guess, so-called non-patient stakeholders, clinicians, industry, insurers, and so forth in our work.
Hi, everybody. I'm Brian Luce. I'm the Chief Science Officer here at CORI. I'm a health service researcher, a health researcher, a health economist. I noticed this morning that my nameplate said Brian Luce, PhD, which I have, an MBA, which I have, and it's an MS. I do have an MS, but I've never used it before. So I, maybe that means something.
You have an MS, but you don't have MS.
That's what I think.
Hi, I'm Jenna Lynn Bowie. I'm a program associate at CORI. I work for the Clinical Effective Research Team, and I'll be your note taker today. And I'm Kristen Stenzel, and I am in the CORI Communications
lots of different expertise from various kinds of stakeholders. And as we start to delve into the question, I want to just remind you of that Diane gave in her on her last remarks, was that as we formulate questions, we need to be cognizant and thinking about the population that we're considering treatment options that we go into any particular study and what the outcome is going to be. And running in the background always is going to be what's the feasibility of this study that we're thinking about doing, what might be the clinical trial design, will people actually participate in this study. And you know, that's an area that I find that a lot of clinical scientists and even worse, basic scientists don't really think about. And when I've been involved in many, many clinical trials over the years, and the first question I think to myself when I In fact, I asked this question to somebody from a company in a teleconference yesterday who was investigating the possibility of our being a clinical site. I said to that person, if you were a patient, why would you go into this study? And if I can't answer a question and says, a patient's going to have a reason to go into the study, then I know that I'm not going to be able to enroll into that study. And I think it's a very important question. In the days when people were asking me, when are we going to get a drug for MS, and we started doing placebo-controlled trials of injectable medicines in those days, it was pretty easy to enroll patients in clinical trials. Nowadays, with 10 or 11 medication options, it's essentially impossible to enroll a patient into a placebo-controlled trial for relapsing forms of multiple sclerosis. Unethical to do so, in my view, even in phase 2 trials. And for active comparator trials, they have their own challenges. So keep that running in sort of the background as we address the questions that we're going to go through. So I'm going to start with the two
consolidated, so-called consolidated straw man. They really should have said straw person. And then we can, everybody can chime in and comment on these particular questions. So the first was, what are the comparative harms and benefits of the different disease-modifying therapies in newly diagnosed relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis in terms of disease progression and disability? Okay, so that is a very important question. Now, there are different strategies currently, I would say, that MS physicians have when starting a patient with relapsing disease on a disease-modifying therapy. Some physicians are very direct, and some physicians, like myself, are very much involved in shared decision. So when I have... So when I have a patient with MS who's going to go on drugs, I schedule a separate visit to talk about drugs. That conversation, on average, takes about 45 minutes, in which I review all of the drugs. First of all, in the community, many physicians don't have the luxury or won't be willing to take that time to do that. And during that conversation with patients, I go over the pros and cons of each of these agents, the tolerability issues, the serious adverse events, the relative efficacy, and there is a dialogue. And it's not just the questions that the patient ask, it's the eyebrows that go up when I make some statement. It's the body language. And when we start to be able to get a feel for what are some of the things that a patient that's resonating with the patient. And at the end of the day, the end of the hour, though the decision is often not made at that time, hopefully we've narrowed the landscape down to a couple or three choices, and we review those, and then the patient goes off and thinks about them. So that's the process that currently happens in my hands. And one of the reasons that I think we are asking this kind of question is there shouldn't be one size fits all. Another thing patients do, in my experience, is they say, what would you take, Doc? Or sometimes they don't ask that. They say, what would you tell your wife or your daughter to take? And I almost always refuse to answer that question. And I refuse to answer it because I say to the person, I'm not going to answer that question because I think any or many of these drugs would be suitable for you. And if I answer, I'm only going to be putting the issues that are of concern to me onto you, and those may not be your issues. So almost always I can get away without having to answer that question. But these kind of issues do raise the fact that we're blessed with having 11 drugs now, but in a sense we're cursed with having 11 drugs because it makes the complexity of the decision-making harder, not only for the physician, but even more importantly, for the patient, if you are in a situation of shared decision-making. Of course, that's easier if you're a doctor who just says, take drug X, but I really don't think that serves patients well. So let me open this to the comments about do we think, first of all, that this is an important question to answer.
I like the way you've laid out your model, but it sounds like that's not really what happens across the country. So can you actually see a geographic distribution to those kinds of decisions?
Well, of course there aren't any data with which I can answer your question. I would say that probably in comprehensive MS care centers, this model more or less is probably followed, because in most of these centers, you have very knowledgeable people who are very comfortable probably with all of the drug options. Secondly, most of the time they're in a setting where they have a little bit more time and less economic mandate to see patients in a
short period of time. And by the way, the way we achieve that is by losing hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. So we can't run our center without philanthropy and a private neurologist. But I don't think there's geographic variability. I think it's practice.
I think I agree with you, and from a patient perspective, I was diagnosed in 2000, and the doctors would not, at that time we only had the injectables, and the doctors really would not say, this is what you should do. And my method for selecting the therapy that I went on was, I am a complete needle phobe, and the idea of injecting myself just sent me through the roof. And so I took the path of least resistance, which is the one that I had to do the least on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so.
I mean, honestly, I think this is really a good discussion because I think it highlights really one of the big challenges of doing anything about figuring out this comparative effectiveness because, you know, what struck me today with the introduction was, you know, that comparative effectiveness research should provide, and I'm just going to quote from the slide, the latest open and unbiased evidence-based information to make decision-making. I think you've just described all the biases that are introduced, all the decision-making, the things that influence that initial treatment decision, like belief systems, preferences of the physician, even though you are not directive, I'm sure there's still conversation involved in making the detect, as you said, body language and other biases that direct in a certain direction. Clinical characteristics at time of presentation, activity versus less activity. And then personal choice that patients have for unknown reasons. I mean, you gave a beautiful example of, I'm a needle phobe, so I'm just going to go with this one. So all of that leads to, at the start of any sort of comparative effectiveness effort, to biases that will likely amplify and carry forward, and we don't know influence the outcome. And they likely will.
If I could, I absolutely agree with what you say, but to me, the chance of bias creeping into the decision-making process is elevated by at least what I perceived when I was first diagnosed as a lack of kind of hard data as it applied to me, or at least my inability to go through the, you know, very in-depth kind of head-to-head studies that I've been given. And so I think you have too many opportunities for people to make decisions based on either factors that are less relevant to their outcomes or are more arbitrary, because I think there is a lack of kind of head-to-head comparisons across the spectrum of first-line initial drugs. I think once people, say, flunk their first DMT, they've been in it long enough where they've got a little bit of a better feel for what the different options are and the pros and the cons, but for initially diagnosed individuals, I think it becomes a dartboard because there isn't enough concrete information that can be processed by the patient.
But that initial interaction, and if that initial interaction wasn't introducing biases that we understand and don't understand, I'm not saying that what I listed was an all-inclusive list of bias, that even a small bias that's not perceived can influence the outcome. I mean, otherwise we wouldn't have to do randomized studies. The whole purpose of randomization of a study is to control for the biases you know about and biases you don't know about. And so that's sort of, I think, with any sort of large study that we might choose, we have to consider that there are going to be biases from the outset that are just going to be there that we don't know about, and there needs to be a way of addressing that. And then you get into, okay, randomization can address that, but then, okay, how do you randomize and get patients? You'd have to randomize with approved therapies, and as you know, Aaron just described, that would be a very difficult thing.
Ethically,
yeah. Ethically, too. So that's, I think that's under introducing. This is a very complicated concept.
And yet it's very important. I mean, if we go back to when Sika was going on that, we had, and that was a very common part of my discussion in those days. That, you know, but I would say to patients, there is a suggestion that Avonex, the drug you presumably went on, may be less effective than the multiple dose interferons. I think over the years there's probably even more evidence for that. But we didn't really know that because we didn't have comparative head-to-head trials to answer that question, so we had to look at the respective placebo control. But if I would have had data to say to you, okay, there's a clear efficacy advantage to you to go on a multiple dose drug than there is to go on, you might have been willing to overcome your needle phobia.
I would not.
No, you wouldn't have, but somebody else.
But
somebody else.
I wouldn't. To me, I was told that, look, you've got these interferon-based drugs, and they all come out from an efficacy standpoint about the same, and we can't tell what's going to work best for you. And so, again, I said, well, the efficacy is about the same, then I'd go. But if you came to me and said, you know what, Revif or Betaseron has a different profile in terms of efficacy, that's the way I would have gone.
But there's one other thing to think about, and this is just me. I have this disease, and, you know, the doctors are telling me this will help if you take medicine. The mental process that one goes through as a patient is, oh, if I take the medicine, I'm going to get better.
Yeah.
Something happened to me very early on into this going on a drug that I felt worse taking the drug, at least from the point of injection and then, you know, Friday night, and by Sunday I was okay enough to think about going back to work on Monday. I mean, that became my life for a couple of years. And so there was this whole paradigm shift. Why am I doing this if I don't get better? Because I don't think you can tell me for sure that, you know, this is all inside. So what's my disease progression or activity? I'm okay, but I still have relapses on the drug. So there's all these things. It's like, then why take the medication? Why take these injections if I'm not gonna? It's not gonna improve anything.
Okay, those you brought up.
From a patient,
yes,
from my
you bring up a couple of very important points. One is the fact that it's one of the difficulties, challenges in getting patients to accept these medicines. Is exactly what you say. The drugs don't make you feel better. In some cases, they make you feel worse, at least on some days of the week, potentially. And you have no way to know if they're working. You have ways of knowing if they're working less than you would like them to work, if there is disease activity ongoing. But if there's no disease activity, you don't know that the drug is working. So there is an article of faith that patients must have to accept, and they have to understand. And I go into, I spend some time talking to patients about how it is we've established that these drugs work, and that there will be some patients who take these drugs that do worse than some of the people that took placebos in the trials, but on average, people do better, and we don't know how to identify them, and we don't know how to identify who's going to respond to one class or one type of drug than another. So that's one important issue. You also bring up another point, which is that studies have shown that patients rate tolerability way higher than doctors rate tolerability as of the CICER and what should be.
I'm not sure. Being able to tolerate taking the drug.
So, you know, if you ask patients to grade and doctors to grade, what's most important in selection? So effectiveness of the drug usually rated highest, but by both. But after that, doctors will put tolerability lower than patients.
Can I just make one comment here? And this goes back to the earlier discussion. I think you need to separate the research question versus the design. I would not get into design now, initially. We would love to help with designs, because that's going to be a big issue. But first and foremost, what are the questions that you think needs to be answered? And that may or may not be part of the care process, which you were talking about. But we're really talking about what evidence do you want to be able to have in order to make informed decisions? And then once you can, if you could come up with some real guidance there, And if you have time, I'd love to have you get into more practical issues, including this one.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't mix the two.
So back to this question, I think probably taking a cue from what Joe said, some of what, the question here, which is, would more information on the comparative harms and benefits of the disease-modifying therapies, be helpful to someone who's newly diagnosed? And I think we heard here that efficacy, among other considerations, is part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So other considerations that I think probably I've heard raised were patient tolerability is also a factor as well. And that probably fits under the harms of the treatment option.
Right.
So just so if there are things here that you would like to enhance or make particular issues, I think that would be helpful because these straw person questions are really our best start with Empicori for discussion, but there are other questions that may also elevate to that final four that we're going to take to the final plenary session.
I don't want to narrow this too quickly, but I think Aaron came up with a good narrowing, whether he intended to or not, and I got his quote. He says, we don't know how to identify who will respond to one class of drug or another.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, to me, I would put that kind of high on my priority list right now in terms of the kinds of things that we're looking at. What classes of drugs and what classes of patients exist and how might they better be matched to each other.
And can I ask a naive question as the... Which is, when patients present with MS, and I'm not sure if the pace of diagnosis has increased since, I had any exposure to this illness, that when a patient comes, is their history to the point where they've come to a diagnosis and a treatment decision inform whether you might take a more, what I might loosely term more aggressive form of therapy or not?
Well, to some extent, to a limited extent. I mean, we do have some generally reasonably well-accepted prognostic factors that can be identified even very early. They're not necessarily totally reliable, but they're a reasonable guide, at least in terms of identifying somebody who has a very ominous-looking situation ahead. And those patients can be classified as aggressive disease, and to some extent, they're being looked at, I think, in the community in a different way, and drug choices may be dictated by that. But there's a whole lot of other patients, probably 90% of MS population, that are in the sort of less able to tell what's going to happen, and probably suitable for many, many different drugs. Let me just ask the question because I think probably everybody around the table would agree that being able to compare the harms and benefits of these respective agents would be an important question to have. The question is, the real question with that is it answerable in the so-called real world in a practical way? And because there are many, many, many challenges.
It would have to be practice too.
So I saw one of the challenges presented in one of the presentations this morning where it said that patients want better data.
Yeah.
Second, patients are reluctant to participate in trials. And that is a very vicious circle to be in. Physicians tend to think that they don't need as much data as would become out of a randomized trial, that their clinical judgment adds individuality and can give them better information. But what I think I have a little bit broader perspective, having worked across many diseases for much of my career, and I think there's a process of maturity of the disease community. And I think of breast cancer, where patients went through a phase where they were marching and demanding to get access to treatments. And then they went through a phase where they were demanding that the treatments be better evaluated and compared. You can look at mammography, the tamoxifen trial, radical mastectomy, in which patients were not only willing to participate in trials, but they were demanding to participate in trials, and they were demanding that the outcomes be relevant to them. And I think we ought to look at those experiences when we're talking about multiple sclerosis, because they ran into a lot of difficulties and a lot of problems. I know we're not supposed to talk about the methodology, but...
Oh, yes, you are. Not just first.
that is number two.
In cardiovascular disease, a very interesting thing happened in the ALLHAD trial. And one thing that was going on there was that the results of the trial were very good, and they gave a message that physicians weren't ready to hear, and patients found hard to implement because the doctors weren't accepting that these simpler, old-timey treatments actually work better. But the other problem that was developing, and I see happening in MS, I mean, we've got 11 treatments now. I don't see that there's going to be any shortage of treatments in the future, and that they were actually developing antihypertensive agents faster than they could do the trial to compare them.
That's a big issue for them.
I know that's a practical issue and a methodology issue on one hand, but on the other hand, it's a talk about the community, and you need to develop a way of evaluating them where you can introduce new agents as you move
along. You can do that with adaptive trials, and we're very interested in adaptive and Bayesian adaptive trials. So that's an example of a question you may want to pose, and then we can bring the design people in.
Well, the thing I meant to be bringing up is a part of this is how to get the patients to be willing to participate in the trials. And I mean, in a way, every patient is in a trial, but they're just not very well designed to get an answer when they're through participating in this, making a decision what treatment to accept. I mean, the physician often says, well, let's try this. And
I would make the maybe brazen statement, but then I'll welcome the challenge. I would make the statement that given the current landscape of 11 available agents, admittedly not all of them are used as so-called first-line drugs for a typical MS patient, but I would make the statement that it would be impossible to do an adequate randomized controlled trial to assess the relative harms and benefits of these agents, even if one selected only a few of the agents, because of the enormous numbers of patients that would be taken, and even more importantly, because of what I would think would be the unwillingness of patients to enter that trial. Does anybody disagree with that?
I have a question. Because, in general, patient acceptance of randomization is difficult, and particularly when it's not a case that they're seeking a therapy that maybe they haven't had a therapeutic response before. So this, I would dare to say, is universal. In the case of multiple sclerosis, I appreciate the difficulties of this illness, and it's very coarse, but is there any way to consider ways to work around this in terms of developing some kind of design that would take patient preferences into account? If someone is needle phobic, I would dare to presume their adherence to a therapy that they would want to avoid would be less than perfect, and then you don't even have a full test of the efficacy of that agent. So just a question about, is there a method around this? Because if you say that there's no way that an MS patient will ever accept randomization within a range of options that they would consider acceptable, then you know, we should just start talking about how an observational study might be done, or how a registry might be established with data capture to get at the biases that we heard about from Michael.
I guess getting back to the importance of this question, if you have a limited base of patients who are willing to participate in trials. It would be better to make that investment in developing new treatments and giving accurate descriptions of their effects that you can have confidence in, and then performing a comparison as we do now. I don't think it's particularly data-driven. In fact, I think it's not data-driven. But is it more important to compare the treatments that we have or to develop new treatments?
Well, PCORI won't be developing new treatments, but I think our idea is how might we help inform Joe and Peter how, you know, among the array of options that they would consider, what might be the one that's best for them. Can we, the information on Avonex, for instance, that you allude to, is potentially lesser efficacy than the other interferons. You know, to what extent is this part of how people are making decisions? Yeah, sorry.
I think the problem is that when we were offering patients a placebo versus another, an investigational drug, and we didn't have drugs that worked, that was, you know, a relatively easy step. When we have the discussion now, and then even when we went to orals, we had enough of a pool of people who were needle-phobic enough that even when you say to them, look, we have a drug that, you know, at least modestly effective, but that didn't want to take it, that it was ethical, not only ethical to offer them the trial, but you get enough takers to be able to test the urology. Now, if you tried to do a randomized trial, in my view, of drugs, all of which work to a greater or lesser extent, and you say to a patient, okay, I want, even if we narrow it to two options, I want you to compare, to either be randomized to drug A or drug B, they already have enough of a bias against one of the drugs. They have enough of a reason that they don't want to take drug A, that why would I participate when I could go on drug B that works? So I personally think it would be impossible to do the randomized trial.
I agree.
But I think it's still a critically important question, and what we should be addressing is how can we get useful information in the context of not randomizing.
And what are you going to collect? Because maybe, you know, we're thinking, how do you do a trial with MS? You always do, you know, EDSS or whatever, something like relapse, but are those the patient-centered outcomes that we should be assessing?
Exactly.
Are those the things most important to
think? We're going to turn to that in a few moments about if what we're going to measure something, what is going to
measure. My question is, are we asking the question of my population? And is newly diagnosed the right population which should be asking this question? And should we be thinking about individuals who are potentially converting to secondary progressive MS and asking the question there? Because if the goal is to change practice, I'm not convinced that this would change practice. But the question, right, as we see with the choosing wisely effort is, should I continue taking this when I'm secondary progressive?
Well, I think that is a very important question. And it's a different conversation for the patient. But I do still think that if we answered the question and could say to a patient, okay, well, if you take drug X, your odds of having a good outcome, whatever that outcome is, whatever it was measured, is this much better than drug Y, that would be useful information to the patient. If we also could say to the patient, well, you have this much more chance of doing well, but you're this much more likely to experience whatever harm there is, that would also be useful information to inform the patient. And I think clinicians would pay attention to that data in their conversations. But I think that is, I still think this question is very important at that stage of illness, because that's the most frequent time, obviously, is being made.
I think from the FDA point of view and our experience that bias can be a very difficult thing to control, but it can seriously mislead you into practices that are unnecessary or harmful and just downright wrong. And we have evidence that that can happen through, you know, if nothing else, the radical magnet aspect of his story. So I think that I would hesitate just at the beginning throwing out randomization and talking about ways to make that feasible or acceptable in the trial design. Because otherwise, I don't know if you're going to know what to do with the data when you get it or how to interpret it.
You know, one question that I think Laura was queued up, just so I know, sometimes down at the end of the table, we don't want to neglect you. Would randomization be something we might better talk about in the case of someone with secondary progressive disease? Is that really much more a case where a randomized study of treatment alternatives may make more sense than that in this case of newly diagnosed disease where we may have to wrestle with the vagaries of observational data and make the best use of them?
Well, I think it's premature for PCORI to be involved in the question of assessing, you know, relative options for secondary progressive MS or primary progressive MS, because there are no options currently.
Well,
and randomized trials are ongoing. Those are the things that pharma is interested in, and those are trials to which people can be successfully enrolled because there is not a legitimate option.
Isn't the question there whether to continue treatment?
Well, that's another question.
Okay.
I mean, that is a big problem because, you know, and I think that stopping therapy is a whole other important aspect of this treatment. You know, partly in the question that Tim raises, because most of the patients, in my experience, that we see with secondary progressive MS are people that we've followed from the time that they had a relapsing MS or put on drugs that were appropriate for them to be on at the time. Now they've transitioned to secondary progressive MS. They may or may not still be having any relapse activity. And the question is, are they deriving any benefit from the drug at this point? And doctors are very unwilling to stop the drugs. So in part because of the views that they're taking hope away.
I would just like to give Laura a chance.
Oh, sure, no problem. I mean, this has been brought up a little bit before, but I think that in the absence of early efficacy data that's really proximal and understandable to the patient and the general neurologist, you know, we do still have the luxury of, you know, of these choices, you know, what fits your lifestyle best. And I think in that itself is fairly patient-centered. You know, a lot of therapeutic areas don't have that option. So, you know, whether it's an oral or a once a week or more often or a long needle or a short needle. So I do think that that's something that's gone well. I think the trick is, can something be designed that has the outcome that's really the trick? You know, what can be designed that the outcomes are proximal to the patient and the general neurologist? It's probably not the EDSS. I think one example that was really good is the STAR-D trial in depression, in that they chose, I mean, they did an adaptive trial where you get randomized to this, and then depending on your response, you move up the tree, up to kind of combination therapies. But the outcomes were very simple. You know, there was a physician outcome, there was a patient outcome, and they were very simple, which allowed the opportunity of comparing lots of antidepressants, you know, which is, you know, that at least equals the number of therapies that we have available to us. So there's some examples that we could potentially pull from, but it really is the trick of, like, what's the outcome that we can say is meaningful for the patient. I mean, your description of no sense of improvement is really important, you know?
Yeah.
Part of the problem is that when you look at these group of patients who are first going on MS treatments,
yeah,
most of them are well. Most of
them
have zero or very minimal neurological abnormalities. And 3 years later, even, most of them are going to still have very little in the way of disability outcomes, fortunately. If you do a patient-reported outcome in a relatively short time frame,
yeah,
it's going to probably be driven by side effects,
fatigue,
or, you know,
or things like,
you know, it's not going to be driven by measurable neurological disability. disability.
Yeah.
And, of course, how the patient feels at that point is very important, and how they're tolerating the medicine is very important. But it might be misleading compared to what an actual disability measure at some point were going to be 10 or 15 years down the road. If you look at a person who's newly diagnosed with MS, you don't typically see really appreciable neurological disability for a decade.
But the experience itself, though, fatigue and mood and just the thought process of doing activities of daily living, you know, the ability to having to pull yourself out of bed to go to work. I mean, all of those, that's real stuff.
That's the real
stuff. That's the real stuff, even at the beginning.
And I think they had written this down. I was trying to put myself back at that newly diagnosed stage and put myself in that position now. And I got to a diagnosis of MS because of my internist and a history of 3 to 4 years of these weird symptoms that he was trying to treat for me and, you know, send me off to this specialist or that specialist. And eventually it presented because I wound up with a diagnosis because I came to him that day. I had an appointment and he said, and I just had this tingling in my feet that I thought was maybe like frostbite or something. And I had extreme vertigo. I was in D.C. to attending a conference, and I couldn't go down the escalators without thinking I was just pitched right down trying to take elevators. And I got back to him, and I told him about all of this. He did his little tap on the knee and, you know, no reflexes and all this sort of stuff. And I was very fortunate. He was head of his department in Maryland, and a few favors, not favors, but, you know, said, I got a little influence here, so... He had me admitted to the hospital on a Wednesday, and after a horrifying experience of questions and tapping and, you know, the MRI and the spinal tap and everything on Friday, I had a diagnosis. But when we go back to all the things that led up to that, that was a 3-year period. I had never seen a neurologist up until that point, and I think that's how most people wind up. Coming to the point of a diagnosis, seeing a neurologist and being diagnosed because the things that, the symptoms that they're experiencing are things that their general practitioner or whatever family doctor cannot treat. And so that's where, and again, I go back to being newly diagnosed, and I really am sort of glad I was diagnosed then because if I was faced with all of these drugs now, I probably would choose an oral drug just because I wouldn't even think of doing it. But I don't know if that oral drug would really be the best one for me. And somebody mentioned compliance. I was compliant with Xenio for 8 years. And I've been off for 7. And I just kind of, I don't know that compliance is just as much of an issue, I'm not sure. But it's always been with me. What does taking this drug, how does it benefit me? And the one thing that was, and I don't think I'm a special case, but probably not as prominent as or prevalent at the time, I knew that I was having cognitive issues about 3 or 4 years before I was diagnosed with MS. At that time in 2000, that wasn't a primary, if you will, side of a symptom of MS. The ability to also make executive decisions, doing it quickly, word recall, thought recall, you know, forget the little forgetful things that I'm old enough now that, you know, they say that comes with age, but I'm talking about being able to process it and having it, you know, to take so much longer. That is the reason, in my case, that and fatigue were the two symptoms that eventually forced me out of the workforce. And so that is what I'm trying to get to. It's like, I think there's definitely room for these therapies. I think the two things you want to look at, that I would like to see people look at, is a clear explanation of, like, its benefits. And if it doesn't benefit, I think for the average MS person, if taking this drug is not going to benefit the symptoms that affect me the most, then there needs to be a darn good explanation as to why I should take it. And then the harm. In my case, it's unclear now that I can take another drug simply because I suffered with liver toxicity on the interferon. And so I've been off with it long enough. People are trying to pull me back in. I'm scared. That's the bottom line.
So we have a lot of people, or a number of people around the table with experiences and patient-reported outcomes. And Sanjay, I think you looked at this. So if we were to be seeking a patient-reported outcome, what are some of the things that we might look for?
I mean, I think it's the reason why even what I heard here was that there is an initiative to actually come up with an expert specific. So we know we have a lot of choices already available. We do put them in our clinical studies as well, but it still goes back to individual patient preference and what for that patient is relevant. So from the clinical trial perspective, we obviously are able to provide an evaluation of, in a group of patients, what is meaningful. But then at the end of the day, as you had mentioned in your discussion, it then comes down to individual patient level, which criteria, which component of patient-level outcome is most meaningful. So obviously we have a lot of choices available already, but more work needs to be done, obviously, as evidenced by what is happening with, the development of a specific.
Right, and there are a number of patient-reported outcomes that weren't really focused just on the MS, people living with MS. So that's why, especially the FDA, would like to see something that really is more
focused. So you're arguing for a relatively broad-based tool that would capture, that would have the potential to capture individual differences. So one, it might be a symptom that's particularly important to one patient that's not important to another, but each would be captured in this.
Right. I mean, they start out by figuring out what would be the top five symptoms that most of the people living with MS would report: pain, fatigue, bowel function, that kind of thing. And then they would try to develop the items that would really speak to those different symptoms.
And in some way, the outcome, it seems to me, should also incorporate the burden of the therapy in some way, which would get at the needle phobia, would get at the potential tolerability issues of some medication. That may not be captured simply by disease-related symptoms.
No, I was just thinking with this whole discussion, as far as, patient-centered concerns and when we're thinking about long-term disease progression, and I've even had people tell me about how if they were to think about treatment, if they could kind of have an idea that, say, their kids were young and that the next maybe 5 to 10 years would be really good because they're not going to be dealing with side effects and all these kinds of issues, and they would have those years. And then long-term thinking after that might not, but they would have those critical years that they saw as the most important times of their life for their quality of life. They would go with that. And that, if you were to ask them, what can I do to make sure you actually have the best possible treatment for your concerns, they would choose that and not, worry. Whereas they wouldn't want something that could, guarantee them maybe longer term, you're going to see less, but you're going to be suffering. You're not going to be able to get out of bed, and you're going to be, while your kids are young and you have that with them. And I remember hearing that kind of maybe it was just making me think about some of these things when we're thinking about, the big questions and what is it that we want to see, and to have that consideration on the table. I mean, it's hard, because I think what we all want to say is you can have good quality of life and you can, looking at long-term disease progression. But if we're talking about what we can do now with the options on the table, I think that's really important. That would be something, to present and to keep in mind when we're thinking about this question.
I think that's a very important point. Short-term benefits, it may be a pact with the devil.
I would have appreciated that. I would have liked, I was 49 when I studied, and I would have liked to get through some portion of my 50s working. I mean, I did the early 50s, but, I probably would have made that pact with the devil if I knew I could continue to work for a few years to accomplish things.
I think in my mind, when we think about kind of the PRO development, we have to kind of think of, like, where's the sweet spot? And I think this is, forgive me for being, you know, slightly concrete here, but, you know, with respect to MS, you have the risk of the disease, the pathology, the symptoms, the functional impairments that follow from the symptoms. So this can be things like hand motor function, gait, you know, balance disturbance, things like that, and then disability, which is like leaving work. So, like, our sweet spot is here, the symptoms and the function, because this is really the right target to intervene before a patient has to leave the workforce. And so I think this is kind of where you guys are headed in terms of what are sensitive measures to change, which is really important, what are meaningful for patients. But I think we can potentially borrow from some other areas, too. I know, like, for example, rheumatology has done a lot of work in identifying functional impairments that precede the onset of disability. Because once, you know, we tend to favor work loss as the outcome, but once a patient leaves work, it takes, like, a whole socioeconomic village to get somebody back into the workforce that really has little to do with the therapy, right? So I think that, and I think that the work is going on that heads in that direction, but to what degree can we impact symptoms and function? Now, the symptoms are super confounded with the therapy, right? And that's the trick, is to tease that out. But where might we even be able to narrow in on how can we improve function prior to the onset of disability and change that trajectory of disease? It's really kind of the goal. And I think that we're getting there, but that's, you know, the way that I think about kind of it's the disablement model and how to change that path over time.
If I could ask a question, because in the Duke evidence brief, they spoke to the fact that, you know, the disease-modifying therapies weren't really evaluated for symptom control. I don't know if, is there any merit at this point to go back and examine these agents for early impact on symptoms, or is that something that...
So here's the problem. My wife, who's a psychologist, helped me. But I think she's really complaining about my behavior. Don't go to a hardware store and expect to be able to buy orange. And I think that's the problem here in the thinking, is the disease-modifying therapy, biologically, there's no reason biologically to expect that they would improve existing symptoms.
They might prevent...
might prevent worsening of symptoms if they succeed in preventing worsening of the disease, but it's not really realistic. So if you look at ongoing current symptoms, what you're really going to be looking at is side effects, not an impact of the
But I think this notion of pursuing PROs makes us much more pragmatic, because I think that a head-to-head, you know, large random. I can't imagine you're going to be able to enroll. I don't think Corey has enough money for that. Really, I don't think you have enough money and time that you need. So I think a more pragmatic, PRO-driven could also be something that you can envision being done, not requiring just academic medical centers, comprehensive MS care centers to participate, but actually be broader into the community. Because a lot of people with MS are seen by community neurologists, and I think you'd want to capture that.
Yeah.
Population as well, and I just can't imagine that you could do a conventional study any other way.
Sorry, go ahead.
So Ann, you brought up the Duke study, and when I read that synthesis, the one thing I kind of objected to was their characterization of all the trials, the disease-modifying trials, as not having anything in them about symptoms or patient-reported outcomes. The companies that were doing those studies, they did collect PRO information. It's not PRO, it's the kind of like SF-36 type of thing that's used for a lot of different diseases because there just wasn't more better instruments available. But that information was part of it. I don't know how much it went in. I think even way back then, the FDA was interested in making sure that when they approved a drug, that there was some kind of patient input into that. But
To that point, the article talks about, says that it wasn't there, but they also say, what were the primary and secondary outcomes? No study puts a PRO right now in the primary or secondary outcomes, at least to this point, because of the lack of agreement on which PRO is the exact PRO to use. So that was a pretty flawed, I agree, it was a pretty flawed conclusion of that article.
And that will be really limiting to any studies to identify what the PROs are and that they're reliable and suitable, because obviously you want to be able to put this information into a label, right? So for the FDA to accept that, it has to be, the PRO has to be fully validated and has to meet a certain bar, which is quite a high bar.
So
with all due respect at the moment, though, the Corey doesn't really care about the FDA. We are in a
post. We're in a post. And I love
it. Even though she works for you.
The quarry is not. It obviously doesn't have the regulatory standards that FDA has, and certainly any peer, patient-reported outcome would have to demonstrate, validity, reproducibility, meaningfulness to the patients. But it's not quite the same as a company being able to make a claim of superior patient-reported outcomes for an FDA regulatory standard. So, again, we're back to, the world that we live in and the drugs that we have and how we can use them better. So, and just a quick time check. We've done one question. We're a little more than an hour into our time. And I think we've had a very meaningful discussion. I don't want to cut it short, but I would like to
see
if there's more to add here.
I just want to focus on two other aspects of this. We have on the one point I've sensed from Don, my interpretation of what you're saying is that you don't think we can get any useful information out of observational or, basically out of observational studies. And the rest, and the sentiment around the table is that we can't do randomized controlled trials. So do other people, have I misinterpreted your viewpoint?
You didn't mention the point that I don't think it's as possible to do randomized controlled trial as the table does.
Okay.
And I quoted some examples of advocacy communities that did some extremely difficult randomized trials.
So I would just have to respectfully challenge that. I cannot imagine, actually having our call center advocate for people to go into a randomized trial as representing my advocacy organization and what they want to come and do. I just, could not, in good conscience, say, call the AMS Society and we're going to advocate for this. I just don't see it. Based on the community that, the feedback we get from our constituents, it would be really challenging. I mean, it's not impossible. It might. I mean, it would be good for the others to speak, but that's just my own perspective. I just don't you can do it.
I want to go back to what I think your initial charge is to say, what questions do you really want answered? I know that there are a lot of smart, bright, well-informed people around the table, but it's a big country, and we've been surprised before about what has come to us that is acceptable. We go through a very rigorous process in evaluating research, and we only accept something around, less than 20% of initial proposals, a little higher than that for repeat proposals. But I think you do need to come to grips with what are the questions you want to answer. And we certainly want your opinion as to whether this is suitable or even possible for an RCT or not. But I wouldn't walk away from the question if you think the question is important.
So I think everybody agrees that the question is important to help patients decide which of the many drugs they should take. Do other people around the table think that there is a possibility that an observational study can inform that decision? Who wants to comment on that?
If somebody hasn't spoken, I'm involved in exactly that. Part of what I do is I'm on an advisory panel for OPT-UP, which is a study that's being pulled together that is very broad, observational in nature. I think I would be, as one of the few people around the table who doesn't have a doctor before my name, I'd love to hear a little bit more feedback as to why observational studies are getting kind of the bad rap that they apparently are, because it seems to me that given the difficulty of getting a randomized clinical trial, I think observational studies at least give us the ability to get a hell of a lot more data than we've got now, to compare across, instead of just doing head-to-head studies, to compare across a wide range, to do it in a way that will get very, I think, vigorous and energetic involvement by the MS community. And again, I'm involved in promoting one of those studies. Obviously, it would be the only one, but I would love, when I go back and talk to ACP, they're going to want to know, why did everybody poo-poo observational, and I don't have a great answer for
that. Well, I think there are many people around the table who will be able to tell you what are the problems.
Two thoughts that I have is that for this question, you'd have to potentially start with an inception cohort, or very close to it, in that we'd have to find those patients with the event of the diagnosis, around the time they start their first therapy, which is a challenge, but certainly doable with the right mechanisms. Second, you would need large enough cell sizes for each potential therapy that's on the table that you can actually draw some meaningful inferences. So, for example, OPTUP is an amazing initiative. I'm actually super excited about it. I worry a little bit that 2,500 might not be sufficient for that.
But that's not, I don't think we're getting, we don't need to get into the weeds of whether OPTUP is good, bad, or different. I'm asking about observational, broad-based observational studies generally.
I mean, I think that one, as an analog, one kind of observational platform that might be making some headway in that area is in rheumatoid arthritis. They started the RISE, which is like rheumatoid arthritis informatics. Something is RISE. Sorry, I should be a little more articulate about that. But essentially, they basically developed an observational registry that meets criteria for things like practice benchmarking and maintenance certifications and quality reporting and things like that, and developed the infrastructure to put it on the kind of the back end of everyone's EMR. And within a few months, they had 100,000 people enrolled. And 50,000 of them have rheumatoid arthritis. And granted, the amount of information that you can get from that kind of infrastructure is limited in terms of patients. But there are initiatives where you're utilizing kind of health technology to try and answer some of these questions. So with 50,000 RA patients, they could probably do something comparative. But it is, the challenges of being able to control when a patient starts and when a patient stops and what are all the decisions that go into that. There's a long list of problems with doing comparative research and observational data, but, I think that with some creativity and, there's some solutions to that as well.
It may be more surmountable than RCTs, I guess what I'm hearing.
I actually echo. So, I think, obviously, this will take a long and detailed discussion, but if adequate attention is given to minimizing bias up front, being able to think about some statistical control to control for the variables that we know where the bias actually would come from, observational studies can be very powerful tools. Obviously, devil in the details, a lot of planning will have to go up front given the fact that we're not randomizing. So how do we make sure that we are asking the right question in the right population, right, even inclusion and exclusion criteria, even in an observational setting, to be able to make, for lack of a better word, apple-to-apple comparison.
So you commented at the beginning of your remark that so long as good efforts are made to control bias, so how do you control the patient's bias and the physician's bias up front in terms of the decision as to which drug the person's going on?
So there are, and again, not to get into a lot of details, we have an expert, Brian Wright, sitting in the back. So first and foremost, understanding what the sources of bias are, which variables, for example. We need to make sure that, again, going back to what you just rightly said, do we have a detailed EMR available where actually the data is captured in a very detailed manner that is reliable, which we can count on, and then using some statistical techniques like, for example, propensity score matching. to be able to say, you know, these two populations are now similar. Now, the challenge obviously does arise when we don't have a good handle on what the sources of bias are, and if the data is not captured, then we have a problem. And that's why detailed upfront planning would have to go in, and the conclusion may end up being that, you know, knowing that we do not know these variables, we just cannot do this. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, conclusion may also be that we know enough from what data we have that a relatively reliable and robust study can be designed in an observational study type of a fashion.
The other question that I want to ask before we move on to the next question is, what would be a reasonable duration for a study like this? When should one look? And again, I think we're being a little bit misled by the terms disease progression and disability, because there's going to be very little of that noted in a relatively short term. So the question is, when to look? And when to ask these questions.
As far as the benefits and harms?
Yeah, if we're trying to pick a drug that...
But that's what I think you're observational. That's just general.
Either
that's
way.
Inherent to the disease.
Either way. When does one look?
I mean, we know it's 6 years. Especially nowadays.
How many
people
years?
People are coming in earlier.
10 years? 5 years? 3 years?
We're talking 10 years. I agree with that. And then to get to that question, what do you do with the information at the end if it's
going to
take that long?
So you could look sooner if you're looking at, if you want to get at a patient-reported outcome that relates to some of the things that Alyssa was bringing up, you know, that sort of short-term experience with the drug. But if you want actual signs of disease progression or disability, you're going to have to wait probably 10 years. 7 years if you have a large enough number.
I think it all depends on what are our endpoints, right?
Well, but again, if the focus is disease progression and disability, if we look at the question, that's what you're getting.
Right.
If it's some of the important symptomatic issues that Nancita brought up, that's another story. But if we go to this question, then...
Well, maybe the question... Now, I don't know if this is going to make sense, but maybe the question needs to be modified to think about disease progression, disability, and quality of life. And maybe it needs to be in conversation, if that makes sense, to be thinking at 2 years, like 5 years, 10, 15. So all these things can then be taken, and we would get this data that then we can compare where did we end up with disease progression and what was the quality of life in that time.
I think that's a
good
point.
Idea.
So you're going to get one answer one component probably relatively early on. Another answer in terms of disease progression later.
Yeah. Actually, this is about a logistical question for PCORI is, I mean, typically the PCORI studies are, you know, 3 years, we're talking 10, if that's something that's been done.
Are pragmatic studies, the larger ones that have a direct cost of about $10 million, can go 5 years, and there is some possibility that could extend longer, so with additional potential funding from PCORI or from other organizations that I can tell you has been discussed for some of these. So if you could have some meaningful information about quality of life within 5 years, that could be very relevant. And then particularly if you're setting up a prospective registry, maintenance of a registry, you know, may not have quite the same cost as establishing it.
Mm-hmm.
You may be able to, you know, find ways for that to continue to generate useful.
Well, and I think this is really exciting, too. I mean, and I because I can see, too, how this question is for people with disabilities just more broadly and diseases that have a progression from disability. I think this is phrased correctly to have some significant implications in other areas as well. So I think, yeah, particularly, I just strongly support the addition of the quality of life measures. I know from our members who represent the people with disabilities, that's a huge issue.
And I would say that also included in the sampling could be specific measurements of cognition. We'll leave aside what measure and something of fatigue, so-called silent symptoms or invisible symptoms.
I mean, you could do in a pragmatic sense is like in years 1 and 2, quality of life, how they're able to manage the tolerability issues, you know, and maybe some information about relapses, and then in years three and beyond, then start to look at progression. So it could be kind of a step in terms of what's a realistic endpoint at that period of time.
But do we think patients are going to stay on drug for 10 years?
Or two no. times to do. What about time to continuation or time to switch?
But that would be another bit of important information to capture. People on drug X are falling off in a year.
I mean, understanding the
staying on
time to first switch and why that happens.
That's different than I'm trying to get to the question.
Yeah.
That's not disability progression. That's not progression of disease. So I guess the question is the right. Going back to what we've been told, we have to answer the question. What we're talking about now is stuff that's not really disability progression. It's things impacting patients' lives, important symptoms that are meaningful, but in the classic definition, this is not disease progression, disability.
Yeah.
So the question is, so for 10 years, if you're going after a 10-year disease progression and disability, then you have to start asking yourself, well, in 10 years, are the drugs people put on now, what's that going to mean in 10 years? Is that going to get to the change of practice that this is supposed to influence, as opposed to some of the earlier things we're talking about that might change the way patients think and feel about their treatment? So I just worry about the question maybe now.
My understanding, though, is that we don't have to be imprisoned by the question. If we actually feel that the question needs modification
that's why
I gave my proposal. Because maybe
the question we're going to be answering.
Exactly. So maybe it's too that focus isn't where it needs to be, and then we're going to shift it and refine it to really get it.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, we're going to shift gears now because of the level.
There are some metrics in all of our trials that we can understand changes in EDSS over a couple of years. So I don't think that some metric of disease progression is out of the question, but I think that we have to expand it. So, yeah.
But I also think that pragmatically, we're talking pragmatically, in a pragmatic trial is 10 million thereabouts. In the CombiRx trial, which was a head-to-head trial, was over 100 million by the time you factor in the donation of the drug and all of that. So, and that was, you know, gave us good information, but that was a significant investment. You probably need to think about what would we measure, and quality of life might be the most pragmatic thing we could measure for $10 million.
And I think Tim has done a good job of trying to capture some of the high points of our discussion here, so I invite you to look at it. Would you like the group, if we're going to move on to the next question, to take a 5 or 10 minute break?
Do you feel that you need a group break, or do you want to go out individual? The bathrooms on this floor all seem to be individual bathrooms. So I would suggest that anybody who needs one go when you need it. But we push on.
I just wanted to point one thing out. As we've been talking, and good points have come up that I think I've heard from the discussion that aren't necessarily germane to the question we're discussing. I've asked Kim to put some things on the parking lot. So others, if they have something that they'd like to sort of reference us to return to later, feel free to ask Kim to do that.
And have I captured the considerations accurately? Please feel free to modify that now before we move on to the next question.
Just one clarification I had is this study, we're assuming that people will switch, right? So it's going to be, they're not going to be on one treatment the whole time. So this has to configure that part out as well.
That was my point.
Yeah.
So that will be part of it. And exactly. And then the other bias that we have to figure out is when people enroll is the bias around what's their client actually willing to let them go on to start with, right? Because we're assuming all of them are equally accessible, which we know is not the case.
Yeah, that's true.
So, you know, an oral is definitely not the average person's first choice if they are on an average health plan. Better or worse.
I mean, that's a good point. And I think also, just to capture a bit about, in the questions there, you didn't have the bullet points there captured about whether the question is actually the right question. That was sort of the overarching theme, I think. I think at least my view and from the discussion is that maybe that question, when we use in terms of disability, disease progression disability, I think the question is modifying to in terms of patient outcomes or meaningful outcomes to patients. Clinically meaningful, I think you've captured there. But I think it's really the question about are we asking, the question may need to be modified to reflect some of those points.
Yes. That's a question to Aaron and when do you want to actually modify the question? Because I would capture the, you want to do that after lunch when we come back together?
That might
or
be a good idea.
Yeah.
And we can even take a crack at trying to do it for the group rather than do it as a, maybe over lunch.
You don't want to wordsmith in a group?
I only had luck with that.
It really worked well.
That's not a question.
Everybody keep in mind we're supposed to come up with 3 to 4 questions.
And one thing, not to be worded to question two, because it's completely in scope, as I think you've learned, to say this question is off point, it doesn't have the right outcomes, it's not the right population, etc. You may also want, if we don't get to it before lunch, to glance through your lunch break at the remaining questions that we've put there and make sure there isn't any critical ones there that you think are important to elevate for group discussion. So we don't, this has been a wonderful discussion, but I, as much as we can try and sort of keep the ideas flowing, and we don't necessarily have to resolve our differences, but just to acknowledge that there are differences that we'll have to work out.
So this question asks, among MS patients who are on a DM team, not a DNT, who have a relapse, what are the benefits and harms of continuing the same medicine versus switching to a new medicine or a different dosage of the same class of medicine? And I would refine this more broadly to who are experiencing some kind of disease activity ongoing. And this is a huge question for MS providers to decide is when do you switch a medication, and then of course if you do switch, what do you switch to? But it's the whether. It's the first question is the whether to switch, and there is essentially no information to guide this decision, with the possible exception of the fact that several studies have shown that patients who are on an interferon, patients who have been on an interferon who at either 1 year or 2 years, depending on the study, have a certain amount of ongoing activity on their MR scan are destined not to do well if they continue on that interferon. That is, as far as I know, and the other experts in the room can correct me if you know of any other evidence, that addresses the point of whether one should change medicine.
Well, they're the short-term comparative studies. I mean, the SAPRI studies left one group on Avonex, after disease activity on Avonex, the Lemtrada left. So they're short-term, but yeah, in the longer-term decision-making criteria, I would agree. And I would wonder if this says experience a relapse, and I know we're not wordsmithing questions, but is it disease activity?
I think we want to look at disease activity, because most of the decision-making nowadays is driven by MRI activity, or at least by MRI activity in addition to relapse activity.
I have a question for clarification. Explain to me the difference between disease activity and relapse.
Relapse is a clinical phenomenon. Most MS...
You mean you experience a symptom?
Okay. Most MS physicians regard new activity evident on MRI absent the occurrence of symptoms as biologically roughly equivalent.
So a new spot on MRI, some physicians will call that disease activity, and others will say, well, no, it's not disease activity until the patient's weak.
And here's where I see possibly a barrier, if you will, to complicate this, and that is there are some doctors who believe, neurologists that believe in doing regular MRIs, and others do not.
I
have not had an MRI. I mean, I have to ask.
Yeah.
And or insist, really. And I've not had an MRI for I don't know how long.
Well, there now is a consensus document that was put out by an international working group that essentially advocates doing at least an annual MRI on patients in inflammatory stages. So I think there's a reasonable agreement among experts that that's stratified.
We don't know if 6-month MRI is better than 1 year MRI versus, I mean, we don't know if you act on an MRI, if that's any better than staying on an MRI. I think that's sort of what this is.
And so, it could also be the comparison between disease activity that shows
on an MRI and the fact that you may or may not have, symptoms, and sort of the reverse. But meanwhile, if you have clinical symptoms and they're severe enough, your disability is increased. I just wanted to put that out there.
You're right.
That's
why the measures of disability are problematic.
Okay.
And to do a study like this, which in theory would be doable, one would first need to define the degree of activity that would mandate entry into the option. So that would require a definition, and it probably would be an MR.
So you
would try to be a combination definition that would allow a person to reach that point either by some degree of clinical activity or some degree of MRI activity or some combination thereof, but it would have to be defined, and it probably would have to be defined as not too minimal, because many physicians would not be wanting to switch to such a patient, and it probably can't be too severe, because then people are not going to be willing to leave them on the same
age.
That would be
just right. I mean, that's, no, seriously, you've been doing this business for a long time. How easy is it to get a group in a room and
establish protocol?
Establish what that level
like
is.
Like the middle ground.
This wouldn't be, you wouldn't be home in a half hour. I think you could probably do it for the purpose of answering
research
question. I think you could get enough buy-in physicians and probably from patients. But then comes the practical question of how many treatment options would you include, and how many original drugs would you include as a platform versus high?
The bias issues that we were discussing before enter in very, very quickly.
I think we're very soon going to be in an environment where there are not enough patients on injectable drugs to be considered, because the patients that are staying long-term on injectable drugs are probably the people that aren't having disease activity and therefore won't qualify. And the vast majority of patients, in my experience, going on first therapy are going on an oral therapy. So I think probably if one were to design this study today, I'd probably have to pick an oral therapy as the therapy to have to break through the disease, and then you have to decide what to ratchet up to.
When we were talking about bias and issues like that, I mean, is it possible, and again, I'm the guy who asked doctors, but is it possible to put a question about, for people on interferons, you establish your protocol and what no disease activity, how you find no disease activity, and then you roll out a study that tests people who are on interferons, who are kept on interferons after some minimal amount, or not kept on interferons after some minimal amount, and move to Copaxone or move to Jelinek or whatever you'd like. I mean, before we just kind of say, look, bias really kind of puts an end to this, are there ways of attacking our question in a more directed and focused manner that would be useful to patients?
Well, one related concept to this, which is reflected in several of the later questions, is this concept of NEDA, no evidence of disease activity, or as a New Yorker, I like to call it MADA. this is the holy grail of treating MS, and NEDA means no patients having no new clinical symptoms. Patient has no new lesions on the MRI, and patient has no evidence of disease progression as we commonly measure it in the clinic. So one of the problems with NEDA is no matter what drug we look, it's only a minority of patients that achieve NEDA over the short time frame
of the study. I think the best day study drug is on this probably around 40%, something like that. But it is an ideal goal. So one way one could study this is saying that, you know, we are going to set as a target NIDA and at time point X, and if a patient doesn't meet NIDA, they're going on to another drug. And the comparison could, for example, potentially say, okay, if you don't meet NIDA, you're going to go on to another drug, or you could say, if you don't meet NIDA, you're going to continue on the same drug until something else happens to go on. But that would get you lots of patients, and there are doctors who believe that that's what we should be doing. I happen not to be one of those doctors. I think it's a mistake, because I think it's going to lead to rapidly cycling through many drugs. And currently, although we have 11 drugs, it really turns out that we don't have 11 drugs, because all the interferons are probably pretty much the same, so that takes us down to about 6 or 7. And then in any given patient, there's often a reason that they can't take one or two, or they already have tried one or two. So in reality, it's often a much smaller group. And if you shoot to a target that you're most likely not to hit, you're going to potentially go through a lot of drugs very quickly and not know what to do at that point. So I'm not a fan of NIDA in the clinic, except as a target I'd like to reach. But that is a big concept now in the MS community, and that would be a way to look at this question.
The only thing about NIDA, you have to then, that pulls the EDSS into the picture, which is very hard to do in a large, non-structured way. You'd have to train people. So once you bring the EDSS into any solution, it really adds to the complexity. Because most neurologists in a large study, but they don't routinely do an EDSS in the way an EDSS should be done. So once you pull that in, that's the one limitation.
Because of validity issues, you can't be assured that doctors are getting the same evaluation.
The reproducibility of EDSS, even in a single doctor separated by just a few days,
it can vary.
It's a highly variable tool, I would say. So that would be the only limit, but you can come up with other criteria that are more objective, perhaps, to make those decisions if you wanted to do something like that. But I do think this is also something that gets to what Tim was saying earlier about when do you stop is related in some way to this, because there's a transition period and people are getting worse, and what do you do in those circumstances? So the progressive transition, if you will, if we could define that. I know it's no easier than me, that I'm not, but just that's sort of an important question, because people are getting treated or they're not getting treated. There are side effects of people being treated during that phase, and people don't know if that's more harm than benefit. I don't know, it just seems like that's an important factor.
And are there ethical issues? I guess there's always ethical issues, but part of what concerns me, I guess, is wouldn't the doctors typically say, look, we found one spot, it's kind of minimal, we can keep you on it or we can move you off it. I mean, if that gets offloaded onto the patient, you've lost your random, the randomness aspect of it, right?
Well, that would be an ethical question to ask on a randomization basis, because we don't have any information to it that reliably informs that. So that's an ethical question. And it's one for which
I mean, I know we're not an IRB.
There's very equal points, because people do different things. Exactly. There is clinical equipoise, but it's a great question, because in a setting of a real-world setting, a patient could say, well, I have a new spot. I'm going to get what I want. So I think it impacts how you conduct the study, because, you know, if people have gadol lesions in their brain, but they're in the don't-do-anything group, I mean, that's going to make people nervous. I have patients with MS. People with MS very nervous, I would imagine.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, the practical reality of how individuals are going to respond to this is, you know, the notion of watchful waiting is, like, you know, anathema to so many patients nowadays. I mean, don't tell me what's really left my brain, is sort of the response. And you know, there may be clinically a reason to do that, but you know, psychologically to the constituent,
don't lose sight of the patient. I mean, what does the patient get out of participating in this? That's a hard sell. We're doing this study, and by the way, we may leave you on a drug longer than we normally would, even if you've got disease activity. So we're studying a really, really important thing. It's a very hard sell.
Absolutely.
This is the kind of switching among therapies happen on a relatively regular basis, which we do it observationally. I mean, that just seems...
That goes back to my point from yesterday, but I mean, from about a while ago, but I promised to shut up, so I won't.
But it's mostly driven by, you know, again, it's the patient experience, and if this is real world, what they are going to be able to do in terms of their health plan. And, you know, the switching, they could have to go through three different things before they can switch to an oral. And the idea of people having double and triple step at it is common. So in a real world setting, you know, patient may want to go on that oral. They got a lot of hoops to get to before they get to that. And that's just, I think, part of the issue we have to grapple with.
In reality, I have a feeling in those circumstances, patients probably fail a lot faster.
Because they want to move through the process.
Right. And, you know, there is collaboration between the clinician and the patient on that point.
Oh, absolutely.
But that is a bias that's going to undermine the ability.
I think you meant collusion.
Politic about
that. Partnership. Do people feel that this is an important question to try to address, actually, you know, if we're fine? This specific question.
It is, I think, in the sense that, and I can only speak for myself, I can't tell you how many, after I stopped with Avanex, how many years I just was fearful that, you know, something's going on in there, I don't know what, and I'm not on anything else. But my options at the time, what was offered and recommended was the infusion,
Pythagoras,
which scared the heck out of me. And so I said, you know, no, I'm not going to do anything. And I haven't said for sure that I'm never going back on anything, but I need a reason to. So this, you know, that's number one. But the other thing is when you think about switching, I was reading a lot of information at one point in time, and it just seems like switching's not quite as easy as, okay, I'm stopping Avanex today and I'm going to go to Betaseron tomorrow, or I'm going to go to Gilenya, and, you know, those sorts of things. There's a process, number one, that you have to think about in terms of your body, but the other part is, you know, again, will your coverage, health insurance, will it allow you to do that? And I happen to know that people who decided to make switches, in some cases, the drug companies are very good at keeping you 1 year, but that just throws off, people don't realize it, but that throws off your benefits too, even though they're providing the drug free of cost for a year, you know, copays or whatever.
Given the point that Tim made about the variabilities in insurance coverage, and given the changing landscape of who goes on what drugs, could one ask in a large enough population the question in a very general sense, irrespective of what your first drug is, if you meet a certain parameter, whichever is defined, you will either remain on the first drug or be switched to any second drug. And then you're asking a much broader question, and you won't be able to hone down on specifics.
Well, I think that's probably be the right question to ask, because I think part of what's driving my concern around all of this is that the absence of some of this information is leading to the environment we're in. So all of this switching is to say, hey, the payers say, show me the evidence that doing this is different. So I think we have to start taking down a path of that question so that we can begin to shift the policy landscape, because I think actually this is ends up being probably more of a how do we shift policy making as opposed to necessarily clinical practice per se. Because I think that's, and in the absence of that, we're going to continue to have the environment we're in.
But if we go with what Sarah's saying, I mean, even if we go observational and we limit ourselves to more objective criteria, does that give us not a perfect answer, but a foothold on a narrower question that can help do some of the policy changes we're talking about, avoid some of the ethical issues, and say, all right, for people who, we're not going to say whether, for people who do switch, we're going to watch the 9 peg numbers. And for people who don't switch, we're going to watch the 9 peg numbers who have hit this whatever minimal threshold, and then at least we'll get a foothold to measure how some, whether or not you find statistically significant variation between people who move and people who don't move who have minimal MRI activity. I mean, something's got to be measurable where the randomness is not as big an issue. But again, right? Or is that asking too little?
Again, when you're, all of that is still introducing the possibility that if your variability is too high, the way we'll go is just to no difference, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's sort of the risk here is that you do something that you're introducing some biases or some variability that basically pushes it to the null, which is no difference between them. And if you're wrong about that, patients could be left on drug for too long. You've done harm. So that's sort of the thing we have to think about with any observational approach is to be able to control for factors in a way that prevents that from happening. The problem with bias is you only know what you know. And it's those things you don't know that'll get you in the end. And that's really the only thing we have to just keep in mind with any observation.
But then in this general study, one still could do a randomized trial.
But
the randomization is simply... It's a little bit simply switch or not switch.
Right. Yeah.
Right. The switch is at the what the switch to is the discretion of the patient or physician
and the other
and what the initial drug was.
What the neurologist was, what drug they switched to.
Yeah, once you're randomized, you're controlling for the known potential.
Yeah. And at that point, so, you know.
But then it's not observable. But I guess
sure
it's observation, it's not interventional. You're right. I'm just confusing the terms intervention and observation.
Are there other considerations that we haven't captured?
So one would of course have to define the endpoint for after the switch. What would be the negative outcome, which is going to be some measure of disease activity, or alternatively, a patient-reported outcome, no or satisfied.
So the
same kind of
outcomes
with
that question
one. I mean, one way to get
a little bit more difficult to measure if you don't know what drug you're going to. I think you'd want something a little bit more narrow and objective if you're going to get numbers you can use. But maybe.
I'm not sure.
If what you're measuring is quality of life for people who have switched versus quality of life for people who haven't switched, it seems to me then you're introducing all the biases and random issues about what they switch to and so on and so forth.
Oh, if they're not blind.
In a way, right,
if
they're not blind and getting this, your randomness is more difficult at that point.
In terms of the getting around the EDSS measurement difficulties, the current this is probably already out in the abstract form, so is being recorded. There's going to be a poster at the Academy meeting in a few weeks that shows the utility of using a combination endpoint of the symbol digit modality, the 9 hole peg test, and the time 25-foot walking test, which gets you many more meaningful hits than looking at the EDSS, and is actually pretty simple to train people to do in those three tests can probably be done in about 10 minutes. So that would be another potential.
And you would probably add low contrast visual acuity.
You could add low contrast visual acuity. And you could, of course, add a patient-reported outcome.
Like a PDDS or something.
The more you do with all of that, though, with any performance outcome you put in these, the more you add, the more training required, which narrows the population of physicians that might.
Yeah, well, I'm looking at that. That's why I think it would be much easier to train a community neurology practice to do the 25-foot walk, the symbol digit.
I agree with that.
9-hole peg test.
100%.
Then it would be to train them to do a proper
EDSS. But routinely, Joe was just asking, it's not routine that a a physician, a community neurologist who do those things on every patient that comes in.
Well, correct. And it's not even routine currently that an MS specialist does an EB assessment.
That's true.
Exactly. Almost none of them.
So, Eric, can I ask you about, in your experience, what percent of your patients would actually be needing to switch? Is it a huge percent?
Well, I don't know. I don't like the word needing to switch because I don't know the answer to that. That's for
rejection.
But if you ask what percentage would meet a relatively low threshold criteria, like sort of any disease activity, it would be a high percent. Well over 50%, even in a relatively short time frame.
Okay. And I have one other question.
I mean, that's why when I said that the needed target and all that information comes out of randomized clinical trials, which have been generally two-year trials, and so, you know, no more than about 40% max, even in the treatment groups, the active treatment groups hit that target. So most people are going to have disease activity over the next 2 years.
And is it known, is there a ballpark figure for what percent of people never respond to interferon? Is it about a third of people treated with one of the interferons ever really...
What do you mean by response?
That it takes care of their imaging disease.
That they have no disease activity. That they don't never
that
have...
That they don't have no lesion.
That they're going to be a very small percentage of people. If you look, for example, in the Benefit trial, which was a trial of beta-seron in CIS patients, everybody knows the first episode. Even in the group that received beta-seron, over the next 2 years, more than 60% of them developed disease activity. 85% of the patients on placebo developed additional MRI.
At this time, what metrics, because we don't have all of this data that we'd like from answering this question, are used to determine whether patients stay or switch? And I kind of asked, I know it's a tough question, but yeah, just maybe it'll help as far as clarify, you know, with regard to we're thinking about what's actually happening now.
I'm sitting on the main guidance, the seat of the pants decision for most. For most doctors, but, you know, I mean, they look at a combination of how much disease activity and how frequent. My own threshold, for example, is driven by repeated disease activity, even if it's relatively minimal. And I tend not to pull the trigger at a first sign of disease activity on MRI or even a first relatively mild clinical relapse. But there are other people out there that say, as soon as I see anything, I'm going to switch. So it's really different. There's no consensus. I would say there's almost no consensus.
I mean, we tried once to do a randomized switch study several years ago that we had a criteria of, I think we had selected two new T2 lesions or something like that based on the papers that you cited earlier. And we found that there was a group of physicians who said, that's too much, I switch when I see one. And then there were a group of physicians who said, I would never switch on two, I have to wait till nine or something. I mean, so unfortunately, that's why the question is relevant, is there's really no good process now.
And how do you get information on all the different types of switches? Because in this sort of study, would we be defining what the next treatment would be?
Well,
or would you, if you left it open, would you end up with all the information in one type?
I think that the easiest thing to do, you know, it would open other questions, but it would answer something to switch to anything. It was the switch advantageous?
But then you could end up with a lot of information on one particular type of switch, right?
You'd have to analyze it, you know.
But that would be the most... Yeah, and that would be the most real world because people are going to switch, but their control over what they're going to switch to is probably a lot less than we think. It won't be a random switch. But we'll actually be making some choices.
If I was living with MS and if I had a choice, and I knew that, you know, most of the people that interfere on have to switch because they still have MRI disease activity, I'd want to start with a more effective drug. Maybe those
people wouldn't be in the category of needing to.
If only, Liz.
What?
I could, if only. I mean, your insurance company's not going to cover Tysabri as a first-line drug, first of all, even if it had better efficacy.
Well, that's not necessarily true.
Well, may not. Okay. And then with a lot of the first-line drugs, it's not like Copaxone has a perfect record either. There is no perfect first-line drug.
But you do bring up a question that would also be amenable to a comparative effectiveness trial, and that is a step escalation strategy as good or equal to a strategy that uses a more effective agent from the get-go?
That would be, I think, a really important question, because we see that would change how policymakers
and access.
But again, although that's a study that I think has a lot of appeal as a randomized trial, definitely would be a hard sell to a patient for a couple of reasons, or at the supposition. Because on the one hand, the higher efficacy agents would either be pills or Tysabri, and the lower efficacy agents would essentially all be injections.
Well, because someone last question, you said you couldn't sell random, right? So what is your opinion on this?
Got a similar. I mean, it's not as large a number of people you'd be talking about. There's probably, you probably could find a group of patients who'd probably be willing to. But it's just sort of in a general. I think the previous study, you'd imagine what you need 10,000 people or more to be able to do that meaningfully over a long period of time. That's sort of where I said the cell is just going to be.
Right.
The more you narrow. The argument. I mean, you could. When you had so many other drugs, and especially if you were in just newer drugs for comparison, you can't make the safety argument. So I think if you compare these so-called higher efficacy drugs to the older injectable drugs, you can at least make the argument that I make routinely to patients is, look, we can essentially guarantee the safety of interferons and Copaxone, but they tend, on average, to seem to be of lower efficacy than a couple of the oral Tysabri, but we have much shorter experience with these other drugs, and some of them have identifiable safety issues, albeit infrequent, that don't exist with the interferon and Copaxone. So then you have an argument, safe versus potential.
And Aaron's point, I think, is an important one in these kinds of setting, because the benefit risk decision making that the person living with MS weighs of, you know, a Tysabri versus a Copaxone, some of those safety issues are very real for some, and other patients are much more willing to be aggressive, and it's just really...
Well, it gets down to the quality of life, and the things you want to be. Yeah. If you're a mom with young children, you want to, you need to be able to get out of that. Yeah.
Right. But exactly, they'll accept the risk. I mean, we know people who accept the risk of, you know, they're JC positive and still taking those Tysabri infusions because they'd rather have a shorter, higher quality of life duration than the other options. It's just the dimensions of what how people approach this is so varied.
Bottom line is, you know, how can we get some useful information, maybe not perfect information, but at least useful, better information than we currently have to help patients make the decisions that they need to make in their real world setting outside the context of a well-designed, randomized, highly controlled
trial. So would a study as it was written there change?
You're talking about the switch trial. I think it would change practice if you could show whether it was reasonable to continue a patient at a certain level of disease rather than change them, or conversely, with changing them.
And I'd love to be able to get enough data so that step therapies are never thought of ever again. I mean, or even that prior authorization would be needed. I mean, it is the absurdity of this disease that you have to go through all these hoops.
To get to where you're
going. You wouldn't do this if it was heart disease.
No.
I mean, it's just kind of, right? And so I think this is where I would see a change of practice on the policymaker side as well.
We got about 5 minutes, I think, till the...
Till 12:30 is when we're scheduled for our lunch break.
So I have 12:24 on my watch. 12:22 on Apple time. So any other comments still on this question? Go ahead.
I was just going to get a point just raised. Would that then be a different question we might think about, you know, introducing when we come up with our questions?
So
that
was this question, and then we're also talking the question of step therapy
okay.
versus high potency.
Yeah, and we tried to cut down the parking lot.
Okay.
For people who may not.
Is step escalation as effective as starting treatment with oral therapy or Skyrobi? Is there right question?
Well, it might even
be...
I'd say versus other therapies.
And then even, I mean, I don't know, I'm thinking on the fly here when it comes to the step therapy, but even the sense that it could be shown or to investigate when step therapy is implemented, where the patient, you know, ends up anyway, if that makes sense, because that's a little different as opposed to how where they start, you know, versus the step therapy, but as a sense of given... like observationally that we, when we implement step therapy, if that makes sense, what ends up happening? Because if really step therapy is just putting people through torture for like a period of time
get
to like an outcome and the study could show that, I think that would reveal a lot in the absurdity of the situation.
So it's kind of like, could you do some type of health system comparison? So patients who have access to drugs at certain levels of their care, and how to capture that from a health system perspective.
Right. I think those are interesting subjects, and I think we should leave them for the group that's talking about health systems.
Good point.
I would like to make an observation, and that what I'm hearing, when you talk about step therapy and the content that you're communicating, is that you're assuming that one drug is better than another drug. And I'm not aware of any data to support that.
There are some data that argue to that point. So it's the inclusion of the
efficacy. I'm just pointing that out. I mean,
you mean from a pure efficacy standpoint or efficacy safety combined?
I'm hearing people saying that they assume they're suffering unnecessarily because there's a better drug.
Right. And so that's clearly not proof, but there is. The inference that there are better drugs from the illegitimate cross-trial comparison. but also from the few studies with some agents where there are active comparators, even though they're not powered to prove the benefit. So these are hints, not definitive data.
And that's the point I was trying to make, is that policy makers and payers, in particular medical directors, are making choices on thin data. And so what ends up happening is that the patient is stuck with a choice, which is really not a choice. It's like you're going to start on this or nothing else. And you have to fail that. And the evidence for why they should fail that to get to the next thing is thin. And it's really all it is formulary management. It's not. That's all it is. And I think if we could shift that through some studies, that would be a very patient-centered.
Well, it sounds like a primary comparison of starting with the injectables versus other treatment options,
right,
however you might restrict them. And the challenge in our studies that Corey funds, we don't pay for treatment. However, I know some applicants who've come to us have worked out agreements with insurance companies who have an investment in preventing long-term disability and complications. Or with Medicaid programs or other payers who may say, you know, we're willing to cover the drug costs that we might not otherwise cover given our current formulary plan. So it almost sounds like a direct comparison of what sounds to be the traditional start on and interfere on, and if it doesn't work, consider something else where we don't even know how we define it doesn't work. Might be a question, and I'm not. It may be one that we can come back to and refine a little more than just what I said.
So make one comment. And I don't know that it'll impact in making changes, but basically, when you do start on an interferon, you a patient also incurs other clinical needs. You need to have your blood done every 6 to 8 months, and you know, mm-hmm. and what you're looking for, obviously, and that may be the case with other MS drugs that I'm not familiar with. But suddenly, you've got a whole new thing to look at. I'm happy to tell you, it's a needle phone. I did not like that.
All right, I think we're going to break it. One thing, besides moving on to other questions, so I think we have one hour is for people to break out.
And then we can break back here.
We come back here right after the lunch break. And in that hour, we really want to try and get our 3 to 4 questions. So I would ask people not to impose on your lunch. Please look through the additional questions. I think we've done a fabulous job on these first two. And see, and perhaps we can even do a show of hands, have people nominate the ones in that longer and more detailed list that they think rise to the top, so we can have some debate. Because we've gotten fairly detailed on these, and I think it's been fruitful discussions that will apply to any future study questions that we raise. But we probably need to stay at a little higher level if we want to give some broader guidance.
And then one other thing that I want to discuss briefly in the session, which already is, we were charged with looking at subgroups, and are there any reasonable subgroups to look at? Some proposed ones on your list here.
We've already gotten to the high, like to the breakthrough subgroup, if you will, to use that language, the active subgroup.
So
sort of going in the early subgroup.
And I would like to say that, you know, progressive disease are not legitimate subgroups, except for the question of whether or not to stop drugging somebody who might have transitioned to secondary progressive. But otherwise, there aren't any drugs, there aren't any treatments, so there's nothing to compare outcomes about.
Okay,
so well,
thanks for...
Pediatric population, that's a subgroup.
So there could be age subgroups, theoretically gender, but I would love to have a work with any race or socioeconomic status.
Do you treat children with MS differently than adults?
I worked in our pediatric MS clinic for several years, and I thought what was really interesting is that the perception of risk and things like that is very different, because you have the patient perspective or the parent perspective. The kid's going to live with this for a very long time. But then also, what was really amazing is that my teenagers, who are by definition, you know, risk tolerant, you know, really it was like they're, you know, they're going to live forever, nothing bad's going to happen to them, but they really wanted, you know, high efficacy treatments that were, you know, less commonly administered so they could forget about their disease. And so it was a really different... You know, the conversation about drugs was very different in that perspective compared to my adult clinic.
All right. So thank you for the lively morning. And you can be here at 1:30.
We'll go get our names
ready. Yeah, I'm going to get my phone on mute while you're doing that, or do you want
to? Oh,
okay. We'll be back.
You.